Thank you.
Well, you're better than me because I don't know your name. Sorry. And what's his name over here by Benoit? Thank you for inviting me. Jason, I understand it seems that you're supposed to say your name several times up here during the talk. That's a winner, isn't it? Yeah. Well, Jason, thank you. So, are y'all nervous? Well, I'm glad to be here. My name is Danny. I'm an alcoholic. And I've had the gifts of sobriety since February the 18th of 81. And the Al-Anon that just spoke, who's also, I think they call them double winners, she's also in the other program, she and I attended the same little home group in Austin when we got sober. And they did a better job with her than they did with me, apparently. And listening to her, I was like, well, I don't really want to talk now. And in fact, I started off, all of the speakers so far have been just fabulous. I mean, they really have. I was very moved by Ronald's talk, very touching. And it was, that's a lot to go with, and it's a great way that he's found to express God's love to people. And Judith was, she was just great. I just enjoyed you very much. I really did. Jeff V, he's our big time, the big meeting speaker, Jeff V from somewhere up, I think it's North Dakota. Isn't that where you're from? He is probably you've got the right speaker there. He is probably one of the guys that I am the closest to, and I allow him to peek behind the curtain with me. So I'm really glad that I'm speaking before him. I've had a great time. I do want to thank the committee for inviting me to come up and do this. I was here several years ago, and when I was here, Howard Polentz, who just passed away, was here and at that time, and so was Jerry Jones and Jack Quarterman and Harlan, and they're all gone. And I'm so glad that I had the opportunity to just sit with them from time to time and learn from them and just be with them. And they were great, great members of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm not usually very serious, and I probably won't be tonight. I usually start my talk off with a joke that I've told just about every time I talk. It has nothing to do with alcoholism, and I just tell it because I like the way I do it, I think. Right. But I'm not going to tell it tonight. That's the correct response. So a lady walks into a pharmacy. And she goes up to the pharmacist and says, I'd like to buy some arsenic. And he said, what for? She said, well, I want to kill my husband. He said, ma'am, you can't come in here and say something like that. They'll put us both in jail. When she reached into her purse and pulled out a picture of his wife and her husband in bed together, and showed it to him, and he said, now that's different. I didn't know you had a prescription. That may be as good as it gets tonight. I've noticed everyone is... It had the good upbringing in that round here. I have a home group. The home group is the Cypress Wood group that meets in the Alano Club, and I go to the Thursday night Big Book meeting. That's my home group. And we're a three legacy group. We don't believe that preaching to the choir is actually going to accomplish a whole lot. We go out and hit treatment centers and go to homeless places and try to make ourselves available to the general public. And so I really, really love Alcoholics Anonymous. I really do. I was just sitting here looking at you guys, and I was thinking, I wish I'd just get this out of the way. My mom died 3 months ago, and she had like 42 years in Al-Anon. And man, I'm gonna tell you what, that's the gal that got me to Al-Anon, praying and leaving literature everywhere she went. And but I remember years and years ago, when I was still drinking, and she was leaving literature everywhere, and I was living in a car. I had an old beat-up, stolen car. It was a horrible car. The guy didn't even want it back. And I wore an eye patch. There was nothing wrong with my eye. I just thought I looked really cool, you know. And I was married. And my wife had a boyfriend, and it was stressful. And I was out of prison. My life had not gone well so far. I was only 34. And unlike Judith, I got to it a little early. I didn't want to wait till I was 28 to get started. I went at it as soon as I found out you could. But I was, I had hot checks out everywhere. I'd been in mental institutions, in jail in Mexico. I'd been in prison twice, married multiple times. And I can say that with confidence that you just had two. I had two at one time. Which is also very stressful. I mean, it's... It could have happened to anyone if you drink the way I do. I mean, and you're sort of a people pleaser. I didn't want to say no when they... So, you know, and things had not been going good. And I was scrambling around Midland, Texas, trying to find, you know, money, actually. A lawyer, money, you know, an answer. I'm sleeping in the car, and I wake up these little cat naps. I just wake up in a cold sweat and start, and I got to have a drink, and I go write a hot check for it if I can find a place. I hadn't already written one, and things are just not going good. My mom went to the Hub of the Plains. They had a big conference, and Johnny Harris was speaking there. And my mom had gone to that thing, and then she'd come home, and she'd gone to church, and I always would sneak over into my parents' house when they were gone, see if they had anything I needed, and clean up. And I had, the night before, I'd been out drinking, and I don't know how I did it, but I guess I'm pretty resourceful. I had taken a couch out of my wife's house, and she'd had a party, I think, and anyway, I don't even know how I got the couch out into a cornfield by my dad's house, and I just came to out there just sunburned and, you know, head throbbing and just, oh my God. And I knew my folks were in church, and I went into their house, and I was just, you know, I'm going to clean up. And I walked back in the back, and there sat a little battery-powered cassette player with a cassette in it. And I don't know why I did, but I just pushed it down and I hit play. And I heard it, Elsa Faye. I didn't know who she was, but I heard her voice. And then she introduced Johnny Harris. And I heard Johnny get up and say, he said, "I don't know what to say because that woman saved my life." He said, "A little over 22 and a half years ago, I was crawling around on my hands and knees in solitary confinement." And he went on to describe the experience, and I just sat there and cried because I'd done that very exact thing. And so That was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I kind of just blotted that out and went on about my way. Shortly afterwards, my wife and I are having one of those family meetings, you know. We've been out drinking, and we're just, you know, passing the bottle and insults back and forth. And she just stopped in front of this nondescript-looking building and just kicked me out of the car. And I was sick. My liver was swollen. I was recovering from hepatitis. And she drove off and left me. This was before cell phones. And I walked into this building to see if I could, you know, call somebody and get a ride. Maybe they'd let me use their phone. I stuck my head in the door, and there was a bunch of people there that were sitting over in the corner smoking, playing rummy, and man, they saw me. They were just very happy to see me. And they invited me in, and I kept trying to tell them I need to use the phone. And they would say things like, if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. And I remember thinking, well, I think you're right. I'm not sure where we're going with that, but anyway, they told me finally, said, if you'll stay for the meeting, we'll give you a ride afterwards. So I stayed for the meeting, and it was a call-up meeting, and it just seemed to go on forever, a lot longer than an hour, I'll tell you. I know it wasn't probably an hour, but when it was over, everybody stood up and held hands, said the Lord's Prayer, and that place just erupted into laughter, everybody talking at the same time. It was during the smoking days of AA, and all you could see was legs out there. And in the big book, in the doctor's opinion, it said that we become restless, irritable, and discontent until we can once again experience a sense of ease and comfort that comes at once from taking a few drinks. And I never once thought, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. What would happen to me is I would think, I got to go. I don't know why I got to go. My gut's knotting up. My head's racing. I don't know why I can't be. I don't know where I'm even going, but I got to go. I can't stay here. And that started happening. And I mean, my head started racing. And I've just got to get out of here. And I'm backing towards the door. And it seemed to me like that place parted like the Red Sea. And here come this little dour-looking fellow. He had a flat top, and he had a young guy with him. He head straight it for me. And I saw him. I thought, oh, hell no, I ain't going anywhere with him. And he walked up to me, and he said, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to Baskin-Robbins for ice cream. Would you like to go? And I thought, Baskin-Robbins for ice cream, be still my beating heart. There is no way on God's green earth that I'm going to go off with a bunch of geriatrics for ice cream while my wife is out with her boyfriend. That ain't happening. But what came out of my mouth was, sure, I'd love to go. And I told Steve Lee that, and telling him, I said, you know, I'm just a people pleaser. He said, actually, you're not, Danny. You're sort of an approval seeker. And I don't know if I like that at all. I like people pleaser a lot better. But that was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. That was sometime in the fall of, you know, 79, I think. And man, if I'd had any idea what I was walking into, I don't know if I'd have stayed. It's just the greatest thing in the world. I felt so bad about myself, and I felt so desperate, so lost. I couldn't imagine me fitting in here. And matter of fact, one of my big problems when I met you is I wasn't an alcoholic. You know, I was an ex-convict. I was an ex-mental patient. I was an ex-drug addict. I was an ex-homeless dude. I was a serial marrier. I had four wives. I'd had four wives, two at the same time, which is, it can happen to anybody if you're, and I married that girl. It was, geez, I mean, I was just, you know, we were just out drinking, and her mother asked me if I was ever going to do the right thing about her. Well, I only met her 2 days earlier, but, you know, like Judah said, we do things rather fast, and got married in West Texas, East Texas. My mother had always said that was going to help, but my mother was wrong. That was the worst 2 weeks of my life. And I left her and got another one. And man, the next one I got, it was not good at all, because she had issues. And Jeff and I talked about this, and I don't know I have a story that I tell that I can tell on autopilot, because for hundreds of times since 1990, I've told this story, and I've refined it a little bit to try to get, you know, to where I connect with you more. But a lot has happened in my life in the past year. And 2018 was a good year because I stayed sober and I hung with you. But things happened in 2018 that took the wind out of my sail. And made me feel like I needed you in a way that I'd never let you be in my life. I've always been a man's man, strong. I get it all knowed up. But when I wound up in the hospital with my heart messed up, when my wife left and she divorced me, and my dog died, and my mother died, and my business went rocking, I didn't know what to do. I'm 38 years sober. I'm supposed to, you know, I thought when you were 38 years sober, you know, you just pretty much sat around and tell everybody, you know, it's going to be okay. I didn't feel like telling you that it was going to be okay, because that didn't seem like it to me. But I remember certain things that I've been taught. Always pray and always pick up the phone. Always have that connection. And I, by the way, I do have a sponsor. And I have friends that I'm very close to. You know, they're Joe, Jeff, and Jason. These are people. Actually, not Jason. That's four times, by the way, when I said that. But I'm adding Jason in. That's five. And, but I just wanted to say to you that Alcoholics Anonymous has been sufficient for everything. It's kept me plugged into a higher power that I choose to call God. It has kept me more willing to be vulnerable when I felt that it was just the wrong time. I like to be vulnerable when I've already got it together, you know. Yeah, I'll open up and share with you because I'm doing really good, you know. It's when everything seems to have taken the wrong turn. At least it's the way it looks. That's when being vulnerable seems a little more difficult. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would ask people to be my sponsor. And I didn't really want you to sponsor me, because I don't want anybody telling me what to do to begin with. But I wanted you to be my friend. That's really what I was saying. I would listen to you talk, and I liked what you said, and you make me laugh, and I'd ask you to be my sponsor. I had like 10 of them, you know, because sponsors were great until they spoke back to you, you know. And I remember one guy that he was Harold Wilson. He was a great guy. I'd been out early and talking to everybody else that's new in recovery. And we were drinking coffee and eating sugar and staying up late and figuring it out. Now that the old timers were out of the way and we could get to the meat of the thing. And when we were done, I was just crazy. And everybody said, you know, what's God's will for you? Well, that's a deep question. And it's worrying me. I can't go to sleep. So I decided to call my sponsor. And I called him up. And I said, Harold, what are you doing? He said, oh, Olivia and I were just laying in bed here waiting on your call. And and I said, well, what's God's will for me? He said, God told me to tell you to hang up and go to bed. And meet me in the morning. Yeah. It was very comforting, actually. I felt really good about that. I'll back up a little bit. Jeff should be relieved, because I'm not going to be able to tell the regular story because I don't remember it now. I'm going to back up a little bit and tell you a couple of quick things. My mother and father were married on Valentine's Day, 1944. My mother was 14, and she had me when she was 15. She'd be in some kind of program, and my dad would be in jail if it happened this day and age. But he was 19. He went off to the Second World War, and we just kind of grew up together. My dad died having been married to my mom for 65 years. And they raised three kids, and they didn't know come here from Sikkim. You know, my dad came back from the Second World War, and he was twisted up. He'd been out in the Pacific and been at Okinawa, and he came back. He was a heavy drinker, and that's the way. I mean, he'd let loose and have a lot of fun. And I loved being with him. We were down in South Texas, and he'd take me out with him when he'd go out drinking and leave my mom at home because she's too young. And and she was also Al-Anon, which meant, in his eyes, no fun. And I enjoyed it. I had a great time. I mean, I just adored my father. I really did. But my mom was not having a good experience at all. And she finally told him, you've got to straighten up and quit. Or I'm going to take Danny and leave. Well, he didn't want to lose his family, but a sufficient reason had been presented to him, and he quit. But he did a 180, and I mean, he went from being this fun-loving guy to everything you did, he blew up. He was a workaholic. He was angry. He was driven, and I didn't know what was wrong. And I just, my mom is young, and she's scared, and she didn't know how to teach anything because she didn't know anything. But somehow God's grace was sufficient. We got through all that, and they provided for me. But I became this lonely kid, very self-absorbed. I made up my whole life, and I didn't interact with people well. I was not a good student. I didn't feel like I was smart. I wasn't a good athlete. My mom would always tell me, "Don't do that. You could get hurt." That was it. But the time I got to middle school, I just had a meltdown. I ran away. They put me in Big Spring State Hospital. I escaped. They put me back. Actually, what happened in between, there was an interim there that I got in, I got out, and when I came out, the first time is when I took my first drink. And I was about 14 years old. I got out, and I stole my mom's car. You know, getting married and stealing cars are two things I like to do, apparently. I stole a car, and I wanted to go down where the cool kids hang out and just be one of the guys. I always wanted to fit in. And I went out there, and I get down to that restaurant, and I'm like, I'm in my mom's ugly 1956 Ford pickup or Ford truck, and it's just I felt humiliated, and I felt, I got to go. I got to get out of here. But these guys saw me, and they invited me over, and they gave me a drink. And like Judith, I related to what Judith said, because I'm going to tell you, my first time I took a drink, man, all of a sudden, I mean, everything just clicked for me. I still felt like I got to go, but I want you to go with me, Let's have some fun, it's a hell of a night. It was a great night. I got drunk. I wrecked my mother's car. I got in a fight. I got my nose broke. I went to juvenile detention. But other than that, it was really spectacular night. I got out of juvenile detention. They sent me right back to the Big Spring State Hospital. I immediately escaped. They brought me back, and they said, if you do that again, we'll give you shock treatments. And so I'm being good. And one day, there was a lady come to visit her little crazy kid. And I don't know what, it was just God's will, I guess. God, is that odd or is that God that she left her car running with the keys in it? We're walking over to the cafeteria, and I got two guys with me, my new friends. They were getting shock treatments, and, we were bonding. And I just grabbed these two guys and said, let's go. They jumped in the car, and we took off. And it's 38 miles home. We get over to Midland. And I pick up two more guys who should have been in that hospital. This is a very, very exciting time in my life. This is my first gang. I'm their leader. I've got a plan. You know, we're going to go to Mexico, and that's just going to solve everything. Now, I'm the kind of guy who to this day will shoot arrows into a wall and then paint bullseyes around them and congratulate myself on being a good shot. And hence the ongoing need for a sponsor, because I kind of get the sequence bad, and then I don't understand why it's not working. But we're heading south, and these guys, you know, as we head south, these guys' meds begin to wear off. And it became clear that they were in that hospital for a reason. And with every stop we would make, it became increasingly more difficult to gather my gang up and get them back in the car. But we got across the border and we got into Mexico, and I sold that car to a taxi driver for a few hundred pesos, and which I thought was a lot of money, and it's not. And we make it over into Boys Town in Acuna, and we're over there, we're having a drink, and this is when I realize I'm out of plan. This is all I know. And all of a sudden, there was this big commotion. And one of the guys that I brought with me apparently had some sort of psychotic break, and he killed a parrot that belonged to a girl that worked down there. And it caused a big, big, big fight. And I grabbed these guys and said, we got to get out of here. And we ran for the international border, and they caught us on the Mexican side, and we went to jail in Mexico. That's what I said. Also, in the doctor's opinion, it says that the alcoholic's problems pile up on him, become astonishingly difficult to solve. This is one of those instances that bore that truth out, because I'm not bilingual. I did not know how to tell these people I want my mother. My mom, pre-Al-Anon, and she's a beautiful young woman. I didn't appreciate this till many, many years sober, but she drove into the interior of Mexico to a prison and extracted me. She paid the price to get me out. She left them there because she thought they were a bad influence on me. You know, we get back home, and my dad says, I think you should join the Navy. And I wanted to say, I have a bulletin for you. I'm an escaped mental patient. And that apparently meant nothing to the Navy. So the day I turned 17, I joined the Navy. I grew big and strong, and I became a CB. I'm a very patriotic man, still am. And I liked being in the military. I liked having a uniform and being one of the guys. I liked, you know, the whole idea, the mystique of carrying a weapon and defending the country, and I'm going to become the best enlisted man with the highest rank. That all of this stuff is in my mind. But I can't do that. I can't make any of that happen. I become a CB, and I start drinking, and at first I can outdrink everybody. But then things start to happen to me. Sometimes I drink and I break down and cry. Sometimes I get mad. And then I would come to and everybody'd be gone. And I'd be in the wrong place. And, you know, this is a problem. And I start to get more and more isolated. And I quit drinking tequila and I start trying to drink beer. I try to figure out what it is that I'm drinking that's doing this to me, because I see everybody else. They take a drink, they get drunk, they go home, sweat it out, get back with it. Me, I take a drink, and the very first, next thing I want is a drink. And it just keeps going. And like Billy Smith says, I drink when I'm already drunk. And I black out. And I'm starting to feel very, very different. And I don't want to hang out with people, and I'm withdrawn. And after island hopping around the Pacific, we got to Guam. And I got drunk with some British sailors, and they invited me to their ship to finish off the night because they had liquor rations. And I passed out, and they went to sea. And so this is kind of a problem. It was a and they always, when you steam out, they always do the, you know, they do the muster and figure out they have too many sailors. And it's pretty easy to figure out who's not British. And 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 we're not that far away. They get a launch to get me back, and you know, and I'm humiliated. You know, this is, I think the whole battalion's looking at me. Truth is, probably no one actually even knew. But you know, I'm more and more isolated. I'm constantly in trouble. We get back to the States, and I, one night I started drinking, and I decided to go to Texas, and which is not okay. And they, you know, they bring me back, and I get, you know, I get AWOL, and it just went downhill. I got out, and a few things happened, and I attempted suicide. And they put me in the brig over in Camp Pendleton and did a little investigation, and they found out they had I had problems. And we didn't have alcohol and drug treatment then. You know, it was the nut house, and that was it. If you had alcohol problems, you were going to wind up in mental hospital, and it was not a pretty place. But they gave me a general discharge under honorable conditions and went right straight to Los Angeles, and I wound up down on Skid Row. And it was, I mean, telling you, it's really difficult to leave a metropolitan area downtown when you're flat broke, you got no car, no connections, and you got alcoholism, and you don't know it. And I learned to lie, cheat, and steal. I learned the difference between selling plasma and selling blood, and I slept behind dumpsters and in all-night theaters, and I hustled. And I would call my parents to send me, Western Union, send me some money. I've learned my lesson. I'm going to come home, and I'm going to straighten up. I'm going to quit drinking, get a job. They'd send me money, and I'd be so relieved that I'd have just one. And the last time that I can remember, I remember walking. I had just gotten some money, and I was just like, I'm so tired, and I want out of here. I'm going to the bus station. I mean, I couldn't have been two blocks from the bus station. I walked by a bar that the door was open, and it just looked so inviting in there. It had a mirror behind the bar, and I thought, I want a Manhattan. I didn't even know what a Manhattan was. And I walked in there and ordered a Manhattan, and it 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, they kicked me out. I'm dead broke. Obviously, eventually, I got out of there. I went back to West Texas. I tried to work for my dad. He had an electrical company, but I'm a drunk. You know, I can't stay at work, and I cause trouble, and I'm entitled. And he fired me, and I started hanging out with the wrong crowds. And before long, you know, I'm in a lot of trouble. And finally, what happens is that I wound up getting the probation, And out of this probation, all I have to do in order for this to be expunged from my record is repay the money, do what they ask me to do, hold down a job, don't drink, and this will be expunged from your record. It's a tough lesson, but you're going to be okay. And I wanted that with everything that's in me. I told my dad when he came up, the one time he came up to see me in jail, I told him I learned my lesson, and I wanted to make him proud. I wanted to be a good man. And he believed me, and I did too. I got out, and I lasted 3 weeks. I was pumping gas for this guy, and I was had the nozzle in this guy's car, and I looked at him. He was smoking a cigar, and I thought, he can pump his own damn gas. And I just turned around, walked into the cash register, and made a cash advance. And, man, I went across the street, had a drink. When I came to, I was 300 miles away in Dallas. And, you know, I just started doing the same thing I'd been doing that got me in trouble to begin with, and pretty soon, you know, they've got my dad's place staked out. They're looking for me. I've got my picture up in places that you don't really want it put up. They asked my mother about Danny, and she just, you know, make up some lie to make herself feel better. My brothers were scared. They were watching the school. My dad, you'd ask my dad about me, his firstborn, and he would say, they'd say, how's Danny? And he'd say, Danny who? And I was dead to him. And eventually I got arrested. I got 13 five-year sentences, and I was sent off to Texas Department of Corrections. And what I can tell you about being in prison is it's very time-consuming. While I'm in prison, I write letters. I get strong. I get full of resolve. I don't hang out with people. I'm going to get better. My mom and I write letters, and it's going to be great. She comes to get me. I'm not going to drink whiskey ever again, except on special occasions. And, you know, you get out of prison, that's pretty special. I got out of prison, And she was picking me up, and we're going, and they've got a job lined out for me. Everybody's in a good mood, and I hit that drink. Man, that was I hit that sweet spot where he just wanted to stop at every truck stop and visit with everybody and have a drink. And my mom and I are painting these beautiful pictures of how things are going to be. And she said, son, what you need is a house, a kid, a car, a bank account, and a job, and you'll be okay. So I went looking for a woman that had kids, a bank account, a job, and a car. And that's the first one I found. And my mother was wrong. And I left her, and I met another one. And this one had, I married her. I called my mom, was drunk. And I said, Mom, I'm married. And she said, I know. And I said, I don't know how you could. I just did it. And she said, oh, my God, you have a wife. And I thought, details. I'm always getting tripped up with these details. And I went on my honeymoon, we got on a bus and went to her folks' house. She was pregnant, an unwed mother. And her folks wouldn't let her come home like that, so I married her. That solved her problem. And we got to our new home. My father-in-law picked us up. We went to his house, very big mansion. He was a very influential man in Oklahoma. I went up into his house. I passed out. I went out on the veranda and looked out across this big yard, and I had married the warden of McAllister Penitentiary's daughter. So I was very uncomfortable in that relationship. Yeah. And what I did, Judith probably knows this term, I absconded. That means to move in a secret way. And my mom, she's still not in Al-Anon, she arranged a divorce and an annulment and wound up getting me 2 annulments. And I'm back downtown and I'm unwed, which is not acceptable. And I'm drinking and hustling. And I meet a girl, and you know, and we fell in love. I mean, oh my God, we loved each other. I mean, you don't usually fall in love at this depth until you get to like a treatment center, you know. I mean, that's how my life is going, actually, you know. I want to cut this a little short because I want to tell you a few things that I don't ordinarily get to say, and I want you to know a little bit about my life in sobriety and how much you mean to me. I eventually went back to prison. She was killed in a car wreck. She had gotten away from me because I was... I was abusive, and anyway, she was killed, and man, I didn't know how to deal with all that, so I just went on a crime spree. I got a gun, and I got 10 years, and while I was in prison, I did everything I could. I got an education. I studied creative visualization and yoga and church and everything I could come up with, because I'm going to be okay. I need a job. I need to straighten. The criminal lifestyle is what's wrong with me, you know. And I studied psychology and philosophy because also what's wrong with me is I got mental illness, you know. That's a problem. I've had it since I was 14. I don't know what it is, but I got it. You know, I didn't know that it was alcoholism. And I get out, and my mom's sure I'm going to be good, and I'm sure I'm going to be good, and I've got everything going the right way. I got a job, and I'm just running scared, and I'm drinking only beer. And it's working sometimes, you know. Because the book does say, it said we can't safely use alcohol. Can't safely do it. That's my problem is I drink, and maybe I'm get up the next day and go to work. But then on the other hand, the next day I may drink, and I'm in jail in Mexico. I mean, it's just like playing Russian roulette. But I can't stand being sober. The longer I'm sober, the more my head races, the more my gut tightens up, the more I don't know what to do. And I take a drink and I feel inspired for a little bit. And then I'm drunk. And then I'm doing things I wish to God I wouldn't do, but I did. And I can't undo it. And so I got married because that's going to make me okay. I married that girl that she was dancing on top of a table when I met her. And she's the one that dropped me off at Alcoholics Anonymous. I spent I spent a lot of time running from the law. I was in a lot of trouble, and I was running from Midland, Odessa, Austin, and back. And finally in Austin, in February of 81, I came to in the back seat of that old car, and I was just, I was puking blood, and I had three old Milwaukee beers. And I knew I wasn't an alcoholic, but I'm in so much trouble. And I said, God, I'd do anything if I could just get sober, if I could just be okay. And two guys come to get me from the club. And they came up, and one of them was John Henry McDonald. And he had a young guy with him. And on the way to the club, I said, John Henry, what am I going to do? And he said, Danny, if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. I said, well, there's a bulletin for you. Well, I said, well, how do you do that? And he told me, he said, you know, Danny, he said, if you don't drink today, don't drink right now, and then right now occurs again, just keep doing that. And pretty soon, the kid chimed in and said, you'll have a minute. And John Henry said, oh, don't listen to him. He said, minutes become days, weeks, months, years. You do this thing we do. You join us in this, and you'll find yourself a sober, self-respecting member of Alcoholics Anonymous with a host of friends and a relationship with the power that runs this universe. And I'm telling you, drunk, I was smitten with a magnificent obsession for sobriety. Right then, right there, I wanted to be with you and like you more than anything else in the world. I started showing up at a 24-hour and over Bowling Street and up in Northland. You know, and I'm helping set up, I make coffee, I wash, I do whatever. I want to be with you. And pretty soon the old timers are talking to me because they say, you're doing good, kid. Man, that was music to my ears. And they gave me a little battery powered cassette player, and I'd ride around and listen to AA talks. And one day I said, they keep saying, let go and let God. And I'm like, let go and let God do what? I mean, it's just like, I don't know. And then I thought, John Henry will know. And I never really could accept down inside that I'm an alcoholic. I have all these other problems. I'm not like you. You're just drunk people that need to sober up and live right, get good. Me, I'm a bad person. That's the way I saw it. But I got to that club. I got out of the car, and I saw John Henry, and he's standing there, and he's got the little coffee. And I looked at him, and I said, John Henry, I'm an alcoholic. He said, yeah, you are. Come on in this house. He said, come on in this house. We went into the Northland Club. It was called the Suburban. Then we went in back to the back, and we went in one of those little rooms and got on our knees and said the Lord's Prayer. And then we talked about the first and second step, and then we did the third step. And he said, some people can sit here a long time and just ease into this program. But he said, there are people whose lives depend on them getting into action. He said, son, you ain't going to make it if you don't do something. And I wrote an inventory. I checked into a Motel 6, and I just sat there and wrote a long inventory, and I hid it all over my car. I was afraid I'd get busted. I shared that with John Henry, and I had this wonderful spiritual experience. I mean, the presence of God to me was so real, and I felt so relieved, and I was like, there really is a God, and I'm really okay, and I'm going to make it. And I became amazed before I was halfway through. I was done. To me, sobriety meant Danny gets sober and he feels better. That's sobriety. And then, of course, if you show up, I'll tell you how good I'm feeling, and that should make you feel better. And then, of course, I would give you rides to meetings and tell you how much you're going to like these people that you're going to meet. And that became my game plan. I'm going to do this. I'm going to live underground in AA, and I'm just going to be a 12-stepping fool. I love this deal. I love you. I'm going to hang with you. And I got way too many problems to be going to that 9-step deal. That's, you know. So I'm doing pretty well. And 6 months into it, I began to have a meltdown. And my head started racing. I thought, I got to go. And I couldn't take it. And I called John Henry. I said, I'm not going to make it, man. He said, meet me at the club. And I met him at the club. And I said, John, I just can't take this anymore. And he said, Danny, what's standing between you and the God that you experience are the things that are on your 8-step list. I said, well, there's some things I didn't tell you. He said, what are they? I said, well, I live in a stolen car. He said, well, now that's a problem. And I said, and in the summer of 1980, there was a bank robbery in San Angelo, Texas, and they got it on videotape. And they've contacted my parole officer and my folks, and they're looking for me. And he said, well, son, you got to go in and clean that up. I said, oh, no, 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 no. He said, you told me when I started with you that you were willing to go to any length to have this gift. I said, that's theory. This is very serious. They will lock me up the rest of my life. He said, well, get another sponsor because you will not make it with that. And I went out and sat in my car, and he left, and I just thought, I'm too afraid. I can't do it. I know what happens to guys like me. You don't have to be guilty. You just come walking in, and it's Danny. Danny has been to penitentiary twice. He's a drunk. He was there. He looks like him. He was a tall, skinny guy. Nail him. I know what's going to happen. It always happens that way to me. And I sat there for a minute, and all of a sudden, I had this epiphany. I said to God, I said, I'm too afraid, and I felt this peace. And I realized that four walls do not make a prison. Prison is something you carry around on the inside of you, and I had the keys to the kingdom. And I... So... I got... The next day, I parked that car a long way from the police department. And I walked in there. I walked in there and I told them who I was, and they sent me up to the detectives. And I introduced myself, and there's several other guys came in there and looked at me, and I told them all about my good work in AA. And they found out that my parole officer was looking for me. They were going to revoke me, and they played that video. And it was just a tall, skinny guy in a grainy video going from till to till. And the second time he played it, it's about 15 seconds long, and I just had this sinking feeling. I thought, I wonder what I did with the money, because I'm in a lot of trouble. Because I'm a blackout drinker, I don't know. And second time he played it, he turned around and looked at me. He said, the guy I'm looking for wouldn't walk in here. He said, the guy I'm looking for is out there. He said, we'll get him. He said, but you get your skinny butt back to AA, and maybe you can do something about the mess you've created. Now get out of here. And I'm like... It probably wasn't me, but when you walk around believing what you believe about the way things turn out for you, believing the lies that you've told yourself your whole life, you run from things till you make them come true. You know what I mean? I mean, I couldn't face it because it was going to be the end of me, but I became willing to surrender my physical freedom to have the freedom you have, and I walked out a new man. And I was no longer afraid to make amends. I mean, I'll make your amends. That's fine with me. Let's do this deal. I'm fired up, you know. And I'm on a couple of quick things that I really want to tell you that I live today. I mean, I've had a rough year. Everybody gets a rough year. Everybody said, you know, the hardest year is? They'll always say the hardest year is this one or the eight or whatever. I'll tell you the hardest year. It's the one you're in. It's also the best year you're in. It's the greatest thing going. It ain't easy. It can be up and down all day long. But if you've learned to go to the throne before you go to the phone, you're going to get better. You know? And if I'm sponsoring you and you call me 15 times a day, you're going to get 14 hang-ups. I love you, but we went over this once, you know. We know what we're going to do. There is no middle of the road solution. God is everything or he's nothing. Those are the two solutions every day, every time. And sometimes I don't call my sponsor because when I'm saying something, I can hear him saying that. I can hear that. You know, I called John Henry on the phone just last week. He calls me D. Brown. I called him home. I said, John Henry, it's Dan. He said, D. Brown, what do you want? And I said, why do you call me D. Brown? He said, well, you think everybody knows Danny Brown. He said, but nobody knows D. Brown. He said, and I do. I'm so grateful to you guys. I live in a really nice house. I got two dogs. I just got a divorce, so I got lots of room, too. But it was an amiable divorce. It was sad. We cried. We didn't want that to happen. But, you know, after 10 years, she wanted to do this. I wanted to do this. And this is just the way it happened. When she had a going away party, I was there. When it came time to do the divorce, to divide things, we just divided things. You know, I didn't know that you could have I didn't know you could have principles in a bad situation. I thought you had to yell and scream and get your way. Give me mine. You don't deserve that. That's not what y'all taught me. You taught me to say yes. Yes, you do deserve that. You know, good luck to you. And I moved people that I sponsor into my house. I got a couple of guys living there right now. One of them's kind of like Mr. Rogers, you know. He's just the sweetest guy. I can get him to do anything, you know. He takes care of my dogs, and we talk AA, and I'm involved with him. And I'm involved with this other guy that's getting out of Starlight. I used to sponsor him. He said, he's going to come back. I said, what are you going to do? He said, I don't know. I said, you come to my house for a while. You come to my house, and we'll do AA. And if I can't help you, I know the people that can. And I believe in God. I believe in God all the way through. I wake up in the morning and on awakening, I was telling Jeff this other day, on awakening, he says, we consider the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. And then it says, what does it say? Huh? Yeah, it says before we begin. We ask God to direct our thinking. That used to really bother me because I was like, I've already considered my plans. Now I got to back up and do this. You know, how do you do that? But then I realized what they're saying. Get up in the morning, settle down, think about what you're going to think about it anyway. You're going to think. So stop and think about what you're doing. And then before you begin, grab your coffee, sit down, have a quick prayer, be quiet. Ask God to direct your thinking. Ask that he remove selfishness, dishonesty, all that stuff. Fear. Fear, boy, that's a tough one. I was telling Jeff today, it says pause when agitated or doubtful. I am almost never doubtful. Unfortunately, I should be. Agitated, that comes a little easier. But the discipline that you've offered me, you said it won't be easy, and you'll have lapses where you won't do it so well. But if you discipline yourself, you will find that you get agitated, and you will find that power is there. You didn't come to this situation by accident. Nothing's happening by accident. It just doesn't. We're everything's a divine appointment. I'm where I'm supposed to be, doing what I'm supposed to be doing. I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that if your house is on fire, mow your neighbor's lawn. You know, that makes absolutely no sense, you know, but it works. My neighbor's lawns are all looking good right now. I'd have to talk for 2 hours, which I do not want to wind up in On and On Anonymous, so you don't have to worry about that. But I could talk forever about the good things that have come into my life, the good people, the good feelings, the self-forgiveness. God, that's huge. It comes kind of slowly because there's just something in me that always wants to say, you know, you had that coming. But, you know, you've paid the price. I do not subscribe to this living amends idea. I understand what you're saying, but to me, that guy that did that, he's dead. I'm a new man. I'm a new creation with a new direction, and I'm the guy that is going to live in this life, and I'm going to act the way I'm supposed to. I'm going to go the way you're showing me to go. I'm not trying to earn my life, because I don't crawl before anybody. I'm grateful for that. I learned that here. I want to tell you about my dad, and I'll shut up. I told you my mom just died. We didn't have anything to say. It was just, I just got a call from my brother, and she was gone. And I never talk about my mom all this time, although she was huge in my life. And we went to her funeral, and I was asked to speak. It was very hard to. But the little ladies that lived with her in that retirement center came up to me, and they said, "You're the one. You're the one that called all the time." I thought it was, they were going to say, "You're the one." But he didn't. They said, "You're the one that calls all the time. You're the one that calls every day at 10 o'clock, every day, and say, 'How's you doing, Mom? What can I do for you?'" I couldn't come as often, or I didn't come as often as I wanted. But I called every day, and they said, "You just don't know how much that meant to your mom." And it touched me. I had no idea that it meant that much. I remember telling Willard Machen, my friend, one day, I said, about a year ago, I said, "But I'm so busy, Willard. I need to go see my mom, but I'm so busy." He said, "Oh, I wish I could go see my mom." I said, "Okay, I'll get a ticket right now. You know, I'm glad I did, because she's gone." My dad, I tried to make amends to my dad, and my dad said, "Son, that's fine. You know, but just get on with it." And I asked you, "How am I going to ever set this straight with my dad?" And you said, "You just continue to be a good son, a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You carry this message, and you grow spiritually, and you do what a good son would do." And, you know, we'd be at family meetings and, you know, gatherings, and we would, it'd be cordial, but there was a gulf between us. And I was 20 years sober. I went home to Midland, and I spent the night at my folks' house. I went to an AA meeting, and when I came home, I looked into his bedroom. My mom was waiting up on me, and I asked her, I said, "Is she asleep? Is he asleep?" And she said, "He's just pretending to be." And I looked back there, and he was this big, strong, handsome man, and he just wasn't anymore. I mean, he was a little old man in his 80s that had time had worn him down. He was one of the greatest generation, and, you know, he's one of those guys, his word was his bond. He just didn't understand a liar, a cheat, and a thief, and a drunk. And I went in, I said, "Can I go say goodnight?" And she said, "Sure." And I went in there to say goodnight, and he had his eyes closed, and I looked down on him, and I just, on an impulse, I leaned down, and I kissed him on his old bald head. And I said, "I love you, Pop." And before I could pull away, he reached up and pulled my head to his bare chest, and he patted my head. And he said, "Boy, I didn't know what to do." And I said, "Me neither, Pop." He said, "Those people in AA, I hope you'll always remember to thank them for what they've done for our family." And I tell him, I said, "Papa, I always do. He said, "Always do that. It's the greatest gift that you, I can't tell you how much that meant to me. What a healing." He was real hard of hearing, and I'd call, and he'd answer the phone. He'd always be him, and he'd say, "Here's your mom." And I would go to see him. When I went to see him, he would be just like, you know, we'd just sit together, you know, and we'd talk about minor things, and it was so nice. And when he died, I was in the room helping hold him, and my brother was wanting to clear away the wreckage of a lifetime, and I had nothing to say except, "I don't want you to go. I love you." And, you know, he just looked at me, and he lay back, and my mom was there, and he lay back, and he died, and his eyes went real glassy, and his jaw just dropped, and I said, "He's gone." And my mom looked at him, and she said, "Dan, what are you staring at?" And all of a sudden, he just got a light in his eye, and he raised up just a little bit, and he looked at her, and he said, "I see a dove." And he lay back and died. I don't know what that means, but I will tell you, it changed my heart. I love you. I can't tell you individually, you kind of annoy me, but collectively, if you'll all stay together, I'm good with that. But you're teaching me. You're still teaching me. You're teaching me how to be a friend, how to be one among many, how to be vulnerable. I have cried and been depressed and been up and down and called people and had a long crying jag with Jeff, much to my annoyance. But it was healing for me. It was healing for me because this is the place where I can be free, where I can be real. And I thank you for that. And if you're new here in Alcoholics Anonymous, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the fastest growing organization in the world. No one wants to join. But if you have what I have, if you have this thing, there is no other place that is effective that will give you the space and the courage and the love and the relationship with the power that it takes to be healed. And not only to be healed, you don't just get sober, but you get to carry this message. All of a sudden, you have real purpose. You make a difference in my life. I love you. Thank you.